Accessing library computer data.
And to make sure history never forgets the name Enterprise.
Hey everybody, welcome back. Welcome to the Penske Podcast. It's been a while. I'm going to forget how the intro goes. If you haven't joined us before, this is a podcast where we are running through all 178 episodes of Star Trek The Next Generation, giving our thoughts and feelings about each and every one. Right now, we're up to Season 3, Episode 11. This one's called The Hunted. It was written by Robin Bernheim. It was directed by Cliff Bohl. And it aired back on January 8th, 1990. In this one, Captain Picard and his staff meet with the leaders of the planet Angosia 3, who are petitioning for Federation membership. They find themselves learning more than expected about the Angosians when they offer to help capture a local escaped prisoner. Clay's coming by to talk to us about this one, and right after this break, we are going to get into The Hunted.
Sensors indicate wreckage on the asteroid's surface data.
No life signs.
Apparently he did not survive.
Data? The drive section? Where'd it go? There's no sign of it on its previous heading. Someone must be at the helm.
Status report, Mr. Data.
I'm afraid the prisoner has eluded us, sir.
Eluded the Enterprise?
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. How's it going? We are here to talk about Hunted. I'm joined by Clay. Clay, how are you?
I'm doing pretty well. It's long good. Time, no talk.
Yeah, it's been a long time. People are anxious. People are ready to hear our opinions about The Hunted.
Well, I guess not long time by podcast standards, because you know you could be listening to all of these in a row, and you'd have no idea how much time has passed.
Yeah, at that point, it would feel like we've been like burning through these on a day-by-day basis, right? But no, in real time, it's been a couple weeks. We might be a little bit rusty. I need to remember what the hell I like to talk about on this show. But yeah, as I said, we're here to talk about The Hunted. Let's see. I guess I'll start this one off, Clay, by saying, you remember a couple episodes ago we watched The Vengeance Factor?
Yes.
Yes, and I mentioned in that one that you had said that you, while you were watching The Vengeance Factor, you thought that you had come up with a better plot in your head about how this alien civilization was recruiting the Enterprise to sort of stop the Gatherers, which wasn't really what happened in that episode.
Oh, yes.
This is the episode.
Vengeance Factor, the one that I've scrubbed from my mind because I hated it so much.
the one with the Gatherers. Well, you had said that you thought the Gatherers were going to be betrayed, basically, by this group that was using the Enterprise. And that is what this episode is about, which I mentioned at the time.
Right, yeah.
It's only a couple episodes later. So what are your general thoughts about The Hunted?
Complete misuse of James Cromwell. I feel like he should have got a much bigger part. Although I don't know if he was really well known at that point. But anyway, he's a great actor, and they should have done more with him. You know, I liked it. we're recording two of them back to back today.
Yeah,
and they're a really interesting two to cover at the same time because I don't know if like Desert Storm had just started or something, but shit got political.
It did all of a sudden, two in a row. It's the same with, I can't believe they had two Geordi episodes in a row earlier in the season.
Oh, yeah.
It feels like it's just bad production.
Do you know why they had two Geordi episodes?
No, I don't.
Because they asked him his advice, and he said, double it!
Well, Geordi got his time to shine, and instead, now he's here doing minor backup roles in these ones. But I think you're right. It's like, this is... We have this one, and we have High Ground after this, and both of them are real political. This, I think they both came out before the Gulf War.
So you're saying they started the Gulf War?
Yeah, the Iraqis might have watched this one, or the one after this maybe more potentially, and came to a certain conclusion about things. No, but this is an allegory of Vietnam, I guess, although I guess you could say it's about any kind of war story, right?
Yeah, I was... I wrote it down as 24th century Rambo / Wolverine / Jason Bourne / kind of Khan.
Yeah, yep. Yeah, he kind of is Khan, isn't he?
Yeah. Overall, I thought this episode was pretty good. I feel like they're working their kinks out. Stuff is getting better. But, man, this one, I feel like they really whiffed on the ending on this one.
Yes, yeah.
I don't know how else they could have gotten out of it, but it's not very graceful.
No, well, this is not the ending that was written. Originally, it was going to end in a bloodbath. Like, the soldiers were going to raid that place and kill everybody, and everybody everybody was going to die.
Oh, that would have been awesome.
They decided that was a little bit too dark for the show, so they didn't do that. But, you know, I think this one's okay, too. I'm kind of wavering on what I think about it. I think it has some, like, weird problem things. But, like, one of the major things that I thought was weird about it was how you mentioned the ending feels ill-fitting. You go through this episode with, like, this guy, Dana Rogar. Is that his name? I think that's his name.
Something like that. Who had the rank of trumpeteer or something.
Yeah, which a very honorable position.
Whatever their army was.
Yeah. He's, you know, you spent a lot of time with him in the first, like, 4/5 of the show, including, like, his grand escape. And he has nothing to do with the ending. He's just there. Like, he just kind of says, like, I'm here, and they go, you can go on your way. And he doesn't even get, like, a farewell with the crew.
Well, they don't. This episode suffers from lack of battle budget.
Yeah,
because every time stuff is happening, it's always off screen. And the ending where they're getting all their guns together and stuff, James Cromwell starts talking about how they've broken into whatever and they're shooting everything up, and it's like, oh, that sounds interesting.
Yeah.
I'm glad we get to hear about this from your 80s-style decorated living room.
with his turquoise turtleneck.
And his giant spherical flower vase.
You know, I have two minds of this. I watched it the first time, and I was like, you know, I wish I had seen more of these battles, like you were just saying.
Mm-hmm.
I watched it the second time, and I was like, maybe it's better suited for this show to not have shown anything that he did whatsoever.
Yeah.
You know, because you have this weird collusion where you see him where he attacks that one guard who's, like, guarding a force field that he wants to get through. And it's shot from a distance. And Rogar just, like, runs over and punches the guy fairly normally, to the point where it's funny that you don't think the guard would notice him because he's coming from such a distance. And then it smash cuts to Geordi's engineering crew is completely wiped out, but you don't see anything. And Geordi's like, I can't believe how fast he moves. Like, it's like, it doesn't mesh well with what you'd previously seen the guy do.
Right. Yeah. He gives that one guard the patented television upward double handed, like, fist smash, which is like a Kirk maneuver. If you ever tried to do that to anybody in real life, you would be murdered.
Yeah. No, that's exactly it. It's like, I almost feel it might have been better if they didn't show anything at all besides him sort of walking through the ship and, like, leaving the phasers that were going to blow up. Mm-hmm. I didn't mind the Worf fight, but it looks so cheesy. Like, they can't film fight scenes very well the way that the show is made. You know, it looks like when Worf gets that shit thrown on him, it looks like styrofoam blocks are just bouncing off of him. And it's like, I didn't need to see this.
That fight was kind of interesting because I don't know why Worf didn't just shoot him.
Yes.
At that point. Because he stands there and he gives him that. He says, like, one line about something, and the lights go out, and then whatever. But
yeah, the guy sneak attacks him, yeah.
This is another episode where Riker could have been used better by constantly upping the phaser stun until he just eviscerates him.
Set to maximum stun, Mr. Worf.
my issue is, I don't even know if it's really an issue, but what limits of power does this character have? He can, like, Tai Chi his way out of a transporter beam?
Yeah, that was absurd. I didn't really appreciate
that. What the hell is that?
He kind of does, like, the ninja, like, where he puts his hands in a circle above his belly, and he's like, and he just explodes out of the thing. And I guess...
And then he, like... He not only explodes out of it, but he, like, somehow harnesses its directional ability and transports himself into, like, a different room.
Well, that was my question. Did he transport it, or did he just run out while everyone else was knocked down? I thought he just ran out while everyone else was knocked down. You think he transported himself out?
I have no idea.
They certainly didn't show.
If he's that fast, then okay, sure, whatever. But I don't know.
According to Geordi, this guy is fast as lightning. It's just another great Geordi delivery. He's like, man, that guy was fast. It's a real callback.
That whole scene with Geordi is amazing. It's like LeVar Burton looked through the script. He's like, all right, I got one scene. I just got to bring it. I got to swing for the fence here. And his delivery.
He's delivery, real.
when they ask for more guards and he says, you want my advice? I think you should double it. Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
It's a thing he used to do a lot more in the first season. I'm glad to see he hasn't abandoned just really selling the fuck out of whatever line he's given.
One take Burton, they call him.
That's all they need. He shatters the camera lens with that one take. You were talking about how you don't understand the upper limits of these guys.
Yeah.
I was wondering, how did they get imprisoned in the first place? You know?
Yeah, I don't know.
Like, did they just, like, sort of trick them into going to this moon base and left them there? Or it doesn't make a lot of sense how you round them up.
They were kind of talking about the moon base. Like, Picard refers to it as, everybody refers to it as a prison because he escapes to get out of there. But later, Cromwell refers to it as a colony.
Yes.
So I don't know if it was like are those two different things? Then I just missed it, or?
Well, I don't think they're ever clear, but I think when Dana Rogar is talking to Troy, he sort of implies that it's really just sort of like a retirement home. Like, it's kind of pleasant to live there. He just doesn't want to live there.
Kind of like
they're given everything that they want, and he says he's not mistreated, and they have like all the food that they want and everything like that.
So you're saying he's a prisoner?
Yes, he's bum, 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 bum. Yeah, he is a prisoner. We just finished the prisoner podcast. Everyone can go to backinthevillage.com and check that out. But anyway, Picard calls it a gulag at one point, which seems a little bit extreme. If I'm noticing anything about Picard in these current episodes that we're going, he likes to make grand proclamations about things. He calls this one a gulag, and he has another similar line in Higher Ground. But I didn't understand how he was captured. I have a question for you. Did you like or dislike the escape sequence?
When he gets Tai Chi's his way out of the teleporter?
Yeah, when he's running riot all over the Enterprise.
I liked the idea of it. I thought it was, I don't know. I agree with what you said about how it's good that you kind of don't see what he's doing.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Even so, what he's doing is kind of silly.
Yes.
So like,
he's kind of a one trick pony. Like, once you learn that he's not doing what seems obvious, it's kind of easy to figure out what he's up to.
Yeah, like leaving the overpowered phaser in the elevator was kind of weird.
Yep.
And like, there was not that. I really enjoyed that scene. When he leaves the overpowered phaser in the elevator, and which is shot with zero tension to it.
Yep.
And except for the one guy who's there with Worf, like, leaning around the side of the door with this pained look on his face while Worf takes the batteries out of the phaser.
Some of that stuff
I kind of like the idea of what he was doing, but I feel like not showing the stuff that they did show didn't really have a lot of gravitas to it, and it felt a little it felt like TV, let's put it that way.
I feel like that sequence was hampered by budgets and how they shoot the show, and the show isn't really strong at doing that kind of stuff. When he first comes over and like the security guards meet him in the transporter room with O'Brien, And he just, like, he gives them, like, the Hulk Hogan double clothesline to knock him down. And it's like, all right, this looks a little bit silly. And I hope you notice how little of a fight Miles O'Brien put up when he was called into action.
Oh, yeah. He got phasered, man.
He did. He did eventually get phasered, yeah.
yeah, but even that scene kind of goes, like, it's tough to buy off-screen brutality and superhuman speed when the stuff that you do see him do is very much that of a slow human.
Yes, that's my main point.
Yeah, there was nothing particularly quick about the way he took out those guards or the transporter room guys.
Right.
And, you know, his stage fighting double axe handle was pretty schlocky.
Yeah.
You know, there was nothing for a guy who's supposed to be, you know, like I said, basically like Jason Bourne, there was no really, like, interesting craftiness to his escape or fighting.
I kind of liked the use of he uses the phaser to power the transporter, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, that was kind of cool. That was my other problem. Why does he have a superhuman inner working, knows all the inner workings of the Enterprise, a ship he's never been on or ever seen.
Yes, that also is another sort of, yeah, he is almost too powerful, his ability to, they just kept adding stuff, like sensors can't pick him up, so you don't know where he is, for whatever, he's like Venom with the spider sense or something.
you fucking nerd.
He does that, he seems to know everything about how the ship works, he seems to know his way around the ship. You know, even though he's never been there.
And he's also, he has, his life signs don't show up for inexplicable reasons.
Sensors indicate wreckage on the asteroid's surface, Data.
No life signs.
Apparently he did not survive.
Data, the drive section, where'd it go? There's no sign of it on its previous heading. Someone must be at the helm.
Status report, Mr. Data.
I'm afraid the prisoner has eluded us, sir.
Eluded the Enterprise?
You can't tell if he's alive. But as a side note, when you're tracking him, I wish Worf would kind of run places. There's a lot of shots.
Yeah,
I'm telling
he
Worf
moves so to... slow. I was thinking that too.
And Worf is only ever given two security guards at the most. And it feels like I was like. When Geordi said to double it, he didn't mean from one to two. He meant, you know, he meant bring in huge numbers of security guards.
Now that you say that, I think that's a big issue of why it didn't really work. And I know, like you said, that's a problem with budgets and whatnot. But there was never any urgency to. I mean, Worf is the security officer. Having a guy going around the ship, knocking people out, and rewiring shit should be his like. The only thing on his mind. And also being a Klingon,
he should be like,
I'm going to fuck this guy up when I get my hands on him. But he's just like, you know, stopping to tie his shoes before he's waiting for his two other buddies to show up. And then they're like casually walking through the halls.
It was when the Riker tells him exactly where he is. And it's just a shot of them slowly walking down the hall. He's like, I'm on it, Commander. And it's just moseying on down. And it's like, what the fuck? I think that's really my major problem with this issue. Like, it's not able to convey how big of a sort of event this is supposed to be, I think.
Yeah.
And it suffers from that. I think story-wise, it has this weird thing where when Dana Rogar is first captured, they have way too many scenes of people coming in to visit him in the brig.
Mm.
There's like four back and forths between Troy, Data, and Picard that happened. Troy goes in twice, I think. And you don't really learn anything. It gives the actor a good chance to do a little bit of business, even though I'm pretty sure it was written where I was surprised by how unsubtle or how subtle it was for Star Trek. Where when he's first in there, he's sort of cleverly like testing his jail cell. Like he splashes around in the water and then he touches the force field. And it wasn't just an actor choice because they obviously had to do the special effects and like the water was in there for a reason. But so it was obviously written. Right. But I thought it was nicely unsubtle.
the sinks in the 24th century just have like standing stagnant water in them.
Yeah, and it just covers it up, and you can pull the cover.
That's how you get mosquitoes.
it's like an old tire in the backyard or something. You gotta dump that out every once in a while. That's true. It's just I feel the episode's a little bit slow for how much action is supposed to be in it. You know?
Yeah, this is, now that I'm thinking about this more, this is kind of interesting. This episode is almost like a dry run of Star Trek Into Darkness.
Yep.
It's like, what's his name? Robards? Rogard?
Dana Rogard, Rogaine? I think. Yeah, Dana Rogard.
Dana Rogard?
Yep.
He's very much like
Khan. Rogard Danar? Roga Danar, oh, that's it. Roga Danar. Danar, I'm sorry.
Dana Rogards is the weekend oldies DJ here in Boston. He's very much like the Benedict Cumberbatch's Khan, not in the way he acts, but like his whole through line and his whole the action that he kind of takes. And Cromwell is kind of like Peter Weller a little bit.
Is that the Rocky general?
Peter Weller is the Starfleet guy who ends up being
I'm sorry. I'm getting my movies spoilers confused. Yeah, I was thinking. Okay, yeah, sure. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
And it's a kind of a similar kind of thing. And you know, he even has his other super soldier buddies that he's got to free and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, there's just like there's a certain amount of. There's like no, for a guy who's supposed to be a super soldier, he's kind of flat.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I agree. I think the actor does a decent job. I don't think the character's written particularly well. He doesn't have a lot of chance to explain what he's. He sort of does explain, but it's not really explored. He's basically introduced. He escapes, and then the ending gives him no resolution whatsoever, which I think is a big problem. Like, if you want the episode to be about this character, he's really only used as a way to drive the plot forward instead of being an actual person by the end of it.
It's actually kind of weird because it's somewhere in the middle, because he's the whole episode is about him, but yeah, you're right. He's only there to drive the plot forward, and the climax. Yeah, it doesn't have anything to do with solving it. So I have a big problem with the ending of this episode.
Okay.
And I
agree with you that just before you go, I agree.
Yeah,
this is like a gross misuse of Cromwell. Like, there's no. Maybe he wasn't known at this time, but it feels like that character has no real depth to it. His performance actually probably makes it better than it could have been. And it's just a real sort of misuse of an actor. But anyway, go ahead with what you don't like about the ending.
Well, to talk about Cromwell for a minute, I think the story that's they're trying to tell in this episode is really good.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I just don't think they tell the right parts of it.
Sure, I'd agree with that.
Because I feel like the point of the episode is to expand or riff on the idea that to create this peaceful society, they had to manufacture these you know, basically eugenics weapons.
Yep.
That are then, you know, when they do all the work to create this peaceful society, they are then shunned by the people who created them.
Right.
Yep. And it's turning the spotlight back onto these people who are basically being huge hypocrites.
Yep.
But you don't get any of that until the last like 30 seconds of the episode.
Yeah.
It's not like you don't, there's no, you know, Cromwell doesn't, as far as I can remember, he doesn't really have like a big speech about it or anything, or maybe a little bit, but basically at the end, the away team shows up as Cromwell and his buddies are getting their guns together.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, good, you're here to help us. And Picard's like, no, we're not, because you're being a jerk. And then That part is not as troubling to me as when Picard totally uses the Prime Directive to get the fuck out of there.
Yeah, it's a somewhat enjoyable use of the Prime Directive, but it feels a little, I don't know if it's out of character, it feels a little bit strange because it's always going to stick with like the main problem of the Prime Directive is that the Enterprise has had a huge part in playing this role, and now they're just going right. they're going to wipe their hands of it and be like, you know,
well,
we don't have to deal with this. We're just out.
Well, I mean, the whole intro to the episode is that the Enterprise is coming to this planet because these guys are going to join the Starfleet.
Yep.
They're going
yep.
to join the Federation.
Yep.
So it's not like they're just stumbling upon a civil war, you know, as they do in the next episode.
Yeah, and it's a little bit interesting. The Federation seems like they could do a better job of vetting potential applicants who come in. You know, it's like, do you guys have any super secret eugenics programs that you don't want to talk about? They're like, no, everything's hunky-dory. It seems like...
You did not mention that in the other comments section of the online
application.
Application you had to fill out.
It certainly seems like it would be a breach of contract. You know, it's like, it feels like the Federation visits a planet once, and they're like, you know, everything looks kind of good. Like, this is nice. This is a nice little tour.
Yeah.
Riker says it's a little boring, but that's about the greatest threat he can levy against them.
Most people I know put more effort into buying a car
than the
Federation seems to have when adding a planet to
the Federation. Yeah, they need to check the blue book values of these planets before they start heading
get
out
the
there.
Carfax. Get the Carfax on that planet.
Hey, the first podcast advertiser, if you want to come on Carfax, come on board. No, but I totally agree with it. I think the ending's a letdown. I don't know if the bloodbath that was originally planned would have been better because it would have ultimately ended up feeling like, what the fuck just happened? If everyone dies...
Well, you know how you make that work. I mean, it is still pretty fucking dark. But you have it play out the way it plays out in the episode when they just get out of there. And then, you know, because Picard has that really... I don't even know how you are supposed to read that thing he says at the end where he's like, well, if the government's there tomorrow, maybe they'll change their tune. Otherwise, they might all be dead or something to the effect of that. And then, like... If they came back the next day and everyone was dead.
No, I was thinking that if the closing shot was the Enterprise like from the planet's surface like warping out of there and the camera pans down and it's just Cromwell's head on a spike, you know, and it's just like it's like the garment has totally fallen apart and it seems Picard seems to be taking a lot of responsibility very lightly.
The way that they use the Prime Directive to get out of there is just so like it's such a we don't know how to end this episode thing.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
it does. Because I mean, I feel like once an escaped super soldier uses your technology to start a coup on his home planet.
Yeah,
I think you're kind of obligated to be involved at
yeah,
that point.
Yeah, no, that's 100% my problem with it. You can't go in there, make a mess, and then be like, well, we don't want to interfere anymore, so we're just going to get the fuck out of here. And even if Cromwell asks for more security, Ben, which I thought was a funny line, Picard, where are all your security men? Yeah,
we only put two quarters in the meter, guy. I'm sorry,
yeah,
I don't know what to tell you. We gotta go.
We get the time is up. Our time is up.
I don't know if this was Cromwell looking into the future on his own acting style, but yep. I did really appreciate as someone who has used Skype video and that sort of communication
yep.
that he was not looking directly into the camera as you do, you know, like, because whenever you use Skype or something, you're always looking at the screen.
Right.
So yep, yep. what the person is seeing is you looking slightly off to the right or slightly up or something like that.
No, absolutely.
So I did appreciate the foresight into how visual communication would actually work.
No, he nailed it. He wanted to come back. He comes back in a couple episodes. Well, he comes back in another episode, and obviously, First Contact. He comes back as
he doesn't play the same character in the next episode.
No, he's an alien. He's a totally different alien. They don't revisit this planet. Yeah, I feel
like they probably should.
They should probably check up in a week to see if everything is okay,
yeah.
and then just go on their way.
You know, it's funny that he's the main guy is so con-ish because. Sorry. because he, I found myself like envisioning a more modern version of this story where he's a lot more dangerous and a lot more interesting.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's, it's kind of unfair to do that, but I've done it. That's happened with a couple episodes where it's like, man, if they had done this now, like if this was an episode of Battlestar Galactica, this episode, this would probably be an amazing episode.
Yeah, no, that's true. You'd probably make him a little bit more unhinged, and sort of like a victim of circumstance, as opposed to, because he doesn't seem, it's kind of weird, he doesn't seem as dangerous as they're making him out to be. You know what I mean?
Right, right. Like, even, like, if you look at Blade Runner, he's basically the same character as Roy Batty in Blade Runner.
Yep.
And you don't see Roy Batty really do anything for about 80% of Blade Runner, but when he finally does, I mean, he's already, I mean, the fact that the actor is amazing really helps, but he's already got this, like, this build up to his character by the point that by the time he actually does something. So when he does, it's like, oh, well, this guy's serious.
Right.
And you just don't have that with this character where it's like, yeah, he gets out and it's just, yeah, well, whatever.
Yeah, he's very good at escaping. You never feel like he, you know, like a darker version would have him taking hostages and things like that. You know, he never really does anything like that. He just kind of evades them because the Enterprise crew seems terrible at, because the ship seems deserted, basically. You know, like there's no one walking around. But yeah, that's about it. I'll just...
I just want to say one more thing.
Oh, sure.
I feel like they missed an opportunity for a good turn on the end.
Yep.
Where if they had had Dirk Snowball, or whatever his name is, Dinar.
Dinar.
If they had him and his buddies go the peaceful route.
Yep.
To go against Cromwell, who is the peaceful person going the violent route.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, if it was like at the end, Cromwell and all his guys have the guns, but everybody else, all the other guys are like, listen, I don't know, I actually really know how it would play, but you know what I mean, right?
You're right.
Like, to bring it back to Rambo again, in the first Rambo movie, he doesn't kill anybody.
Right.
It's the people who are supposed to be the ones who know better and are in charge are the ones who are doing all the violence.
Yep.
So that
would
have been a nice turn if they had done something like that with the end of it.
Yeah. No, yeah, I totally understand that. It is weird that this is a Vietnam allegory many years after Vietnam and before the Gulf War. It feels like it's a weirdly timed episode. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
it is. Especially when, if you're looking at like war-based movies that are coming out at that time, they're all like jokey. Like,
oh right, yeah.
The '80s is a really weird time for war movies because there was no one to actually fight.
Right. Yeah.
So
yeah.
You get stuff like Stripes and Top Gun and Heartbreak Ridge, or that Clint Eastwood movie, where Red Dawn, they obviously have people to fight, but
yeah.
The ones that are actually military based movies, you always have these things where like the first 2/3 of the movie are really good because it's all like, oh, we're in the army and we're doing shit, but then they actually have to do something,
and
it's always the most contrived bullshit. I obviously Stripes is a comedy, but I mean they end up like invading some Eastern Bloc country for it doesn't make it, there's nobody to fight.
Well, they,
and even in,
no,
I was just
gonna
say, even in Top Gun, the guys they fight at the end are like, I've seen that movie like 3 times. I don't even know who they fight in that movie.
Right.
They're just referred to as MIGs.
As MIGs, yeah. Yeah. It's, they didn't want to get too close. I guess they're being produced at a time where we didn't really have, you have the Russians, but it's not like you're in open warfare with the Russians at that point. They're just kind of
right.
There. So the war stories at that time had sort of run out of they didn't have a fresh enough perspective on stories to tell because we weren't really involved in active warfare.
If you wanted to fight the Russians, the only way you could do it was either they invade Boulder, Colorado, or wherever the fuck Red Dawn's supposed to take place, or you beat them in boxing.
Yes. Those are both very symbolic and very heavy. No, I totally agree. But let's, we'll wrap it up. I'll give a couple of trivia things. Stephen Ira Bear, or Ira Steven Bear. I forget which order it is, but Bear anyway. He did a uncredited rewrite of this script. It was his first involvement with the show, and he wrote the escape sequence, which was not in the original script.
And he was fired shortly thereafter.
Well, he goes on to... He only lasts a season on TNG, but he becomes the showrunner of Deep Space Nine for most of its run. So there was that. This is the first appearance of the new Brig. This is the first appearance of the Jeffries tube, which is not really what the Jeffries tube would become later on, but it's a...
Oh, yeah. What the hell was that? I heard them talking about it, but I didn't understand what it was.
It's just the thing that... Daynar is walking through when he's leaving the phasers in the wall.
Later on,
it turns into...
So an air vent.
Yeah, later on it turns it into more of like a crawl space that you have to crawl through to get out anywhere.
Okay. Gotcha.
And yeah, that's pretty much it. So it's the first mention of the Jeffries tube, I think, in TNG. I think it was mentioned in the original series, and it's the new Brig. But yeah, right after this break, me and Clay are going to come back, give our final thoughts and a rating.
Success, Captain.
Number one,
will you note in our report that if the government of Angotia survives the night, we will offer them Federation assistance in their efforts to reprogram their veterans.
And if the government doesn't survive?
I have a feeling they will choose to. Mr. Crusher, set coordinates for Starbase Lyra 3.
Coordinates set, sir.
Engage.
Okay, Clay, now it's up to you. On a scale of 1 to 5, what are you going to give this show?
3? 3.5, maybe? I would say 3.
Okay, 3, yeah. I went back and forth. I sort of wavered. I think this one's either... Yeah, it's either like a 3 or a super weak 4. I guess I'll go with a 3. I think I will settle on a 3 with you. I think this is pretty much an average episode of Star Trek that could have been a little bit better.
Yeah, I agree completely.
Yeah, it's I wouldn't say it's a skip. I'd probably recommend watching it if you were going all the way through. It's definitely not one of the skipper ones, but it's not it's nothing really to blow your socks off.
Yeah, I would definitely watch it. I think the ideas that they're playing with are interesting.
Yep.
I just don't think it was executed to its fullest potential.
Interesting. Well, we'll remember that last thing you said as we get ready to talk about The High Ground right after this. But Clay, thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
You're one of the fan favorites. People always ask when Clay's coming back on, and not just your parents.
I've been told this is actually my podcast.
That's true. Should I tell that story? It's a I post on the Star Trek Reddit occasionally, and someone had posted a thread asking about the Neutral Zone, the TNG episode, and I just left our sort of general breakdown of that as like, you know, the Neutral Zone is basically a shitty version of the original series Balance of Terror and Space Seed if they were smashed together, but done pretty shitty. And someone replied to me saying, if you thought that, you should listen to Clay McCormick's Star Trek podcast, which is on YouTube.
Yeah.
I was like, wow, that is a backhanded compliment if I've ever heard one. Not even backhanded,
If this podcast is the Enterprise, I just overloaded your phasers.
You absolutely did, yeah. You Riker just mutinied on what's going on here. But no, thank you for coming on, Clay. It's always good to talk to you. And we will be back with The High Ground very soon.